Busy show Tuesday, January 18th, 2022, right here on Connecticut Today. Connecticut Education Association President Kate Diaz and VP Jocelyn Delancey joined us to talk about the current concerns regarding COVID-19 in Connecticut schools and a perceived disconnect, perhaps, between the union and what they're hearing from Governor Ned Lamont. Southern Connecticut State University economics professor James Thorson made a return appearance, giving us his thoughts on the growing U.S. inflation problem. Well, there's been a lot of talk about what the governor is saying regarding COVID-19 and testing in schools and teachers, and what some of the teachers' unions are saying. And we had that day where a lot of the teachers a few days ago wore black just to raise awareness, heighten awareness of some issues they say are still going on in the schools. So going to be joined by a couple of guests here. Number one is Kate Diaz. Kate is president of the Connecticut Education Association. Hey, Kate, it's Paul at WICC. How are you?
How are you today?
Oh, I'm good. You know, long weekend, but I'm back, you know, and my door key still works and my parking space is there. So, and joining us also is Jocelyn Delancey. Now, she is VP of the CEA, 17-year teacher, and taught multi-grades in Darien. Hey, Jocelyn, it's Paul. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. So, first of all, you two ladies, numerous years teaching. Kate, we'll start with you. 21 years, math teacher at Manchester High School. So be honest with me. You're writing a book, right, about how many different excuses you got for when the homework wasn't turned in, right? Was that a product of 21 years?
Oh, a product of that? I mean, we can certainly have a novel on that, as well as just the joys of working with teenagers, because they are a wonderfully interesting and unpredictable group of people.
Interesting and unpredictable. Yes, I have family members and friends who are in that teaching era. And yeah, Kay, they say that as well. And Jocelyn, 17 years for you teaching younger kids, right, in Fairfield County?
That is correct. I've taught third, fourth, and fifth graders.
So you get them right in those years where you're molding them into the adults they'll become, right?
Yeah, pretty much. Although some of them think they're already adults.
Well, yeah, of course, been there, done that with my son, yeah. So, ladies, let's talk about the issue at hand. We'll start with you, Kate, as president of the CEA. You know, it's interesting, I've been talking about this over the past month or so on my show. You know, the governor gets out there every so often doing what he can do during the pandemic, and he gets these questions about, well, governor, you're saying kind of one thing, and there's a little bit of a different vibe, governor, coming from the unions, the AFT Connecticut and the CEA as to the safety in schools, and particularly, Kate, the supplies, the PPE, the masks, the testing that your rank and file teachers have access to. And Kate, I thought there was a little bit of a disconnect maybe over the past couple of weeks. How do you see the situation from your point, Kate, as the head of the CEA? What are you seeing and saying and hearing, rather, from your rank and file?
So disconnect is exactly how I would describe it. I think that there are intentions to get things out, and then I think there's the practical matter of getting those supplies in the hands of the people that need them. You know, we started talking in December about getting things to the people who need them on those first days back at school, and it took weeks to get N95 and KN95s into people's hands. So I think there was this thought process that we bought these masks, they'll definitely get in their hands, and that's not what happened. And so I think for our purposes, you know, we really started to have a high level of frustration that we're going back into these schools. And keep in mind that corporate America was sending people home. We had businesses who were like, hey, stay home for, a week to, let's ride out this Omicron variant a little bit. And our teachers were headed back into the schools immediately following the holidays, really with strong reservations, knowing what the variant looks like. And our assurance that we were provided is, oh, no, we're going to have these masks. We ordered 6 million. You know, we heard all the same rhetoric as well. You know, there's going to be masks. They're going to be right there ready for you to go. And when that wasn't the case, you know, it was a real frustration for our teachers. They're like, we're in these classrooms with 20, 25 kids. We don't know vaccination status because we don't track that. So we have to presume, hey, you know, anything can happen. And at the very least, getting the high quality masks that the CDC is telling me is going to help keep me in the classroom, because our teachers aren't necessarily scared that they're going to, you know, die from COVID, perhaps. But what they definitely recognize is if they get it, they can't be in their classroom.
Mm-hmm.
So really, preventing the spread was a huge priority for our educators.
And Kate, when he was pushed on this, you probably saw some of the same video and audio. The governor said, "Well, you know, we deliver to the municipalities, and they have to then fan it out to the schools." What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that's a really nice way to pass the buck and have no follow through. I mean, at some point, somebody needs to be following up and saying, did those things get where they were supposed to go? You know, we also had this situation where municipalities sent recalled masks from an old order into schools. And, you know, so we can't have that. That can't be what's happening in our school buildings. So there has to be accountability. At some point, you know, if the state is purchasing 6 million in masks and sending them to municipalities, they don't get to just kind of, you know, go, okay, job's done. At some point, there has to be follow through with the municipalities to assure that what he's out there promising is what's actually occurring.
Jocelyn, it must be difficult as for your teachers, for your rank and file teachers, Jocelyn, who are there to do their job. I mean, they're doing the best they can, having to concentrate on those students. But I would think there's this little pall hanging over, like, how safe is this classroom? How safe is the school? What about my own physical safety as a teacher?
So I think that that's a big part of it. I think that generally, and especially for those teachers who've been in school in person longer, because, you know, some schools went back at different times, it's not necessarily, like Kate said, the threat of imminent, you know, really poor health conditions. Many of us are vaccinated and feel that there's a level of protection. It's the care and the investment in, you want us to be in the buildings. You want us to be here. We're here. We're teaching kids. Our Connecticut teachers are out there giving 150 or more percent of themselves to our students. And there's not the follow through of care to say, we're going to make sure that you can be in school in the right way. We know how to stay there safely. We know the parameters to put in place to make sure that the spread is mitigated. And we're not getting that same care on follow through, whether it's the municipalities, whether it's, district leadership. We can recognize there are districts who went back on January 3rd the right way. There are who went back, but not enough and not consistently throughout. So it's really hard for teachers, and you're forgetting the one most important supply for us to be prepared in schools is actually the teachers. And we didn't have as many teachers in place as we needed to be able to truly support because they were out sick.
Jocelyn DeLancey is vice president of the Connecticut Education Association. She joins Kate Diaz, the president, for this. We'll do more on this straight ahead. We'll take a break. Ladies, hang on. Traffic and weather together right here on WICC. And we continue for a few more minutes with two officials from the Connecticut Education Association. Kate Diaz, the president of the CEA, a 21-year math teacher from Manchester High School, and the vice president, Jocelyn DeLancey, 17 years teaching third, fourth, and fifth graders in the Darien school system. Jocelyn, I want to pick up with you before we go back to Kate. Something you said interested me a couple of seconds ago, that there were some school systems better prepared than others to go back and give this a shot for the second semester here amid the COVID spike with Omicron. Why was that? Why do you think there was that difference, and how stark was that?
I think it was pretty stark where we saw, you know, there were, I can give an example of New Canaan, who
sure.
Superintendent, you know, went out and actually helped to make sure that masks were delivered and made sure that tests were available. I think it has to do with the communication and the collaboration with the leadership, you know, with the teachers, leaders, and the district leaders and the town. And I think the more collaborative and communicative they were, the better able they were to support their teachers.
So, Kate Diaz, has the communication been as good as it can be, do you think, between your union and the executive branch, the governor's office, or not?
Well, I think we've had a lot of opportunities to speak with the State Department. Charlene Russell Tucker has made sure that we meet every other week with both myself, the head of the AFT, and the head of the superintendent's organization. We meet and discuss whatever our concerns were. And so, I mean, I think information is flowing in terms of us being able to say, hey, we're really concerned about this. It's how we knew that there were masks available, how we knew that there were tests were coming. And I got that information around to my members, which is why I think there was a challenge with we were under one impression that there were going to be masks available. And, you know, we're not trying to escalate sort of the circumstances. We're just trying to operate within what we know to be true, which is a variant that's spreading rapidly. And so, you know, there are times where people get a little like, hey, are we making this, you know, harder by really bringing attention to this? And I would argue that, you know, we're really talking about the things that matter in terms of keeping schools open, which we all know is not just a priority of the executive branch, but of ourselves. We realize the best place for kids to be is with their teachers. So we need to keep those teachers safe.
Are you hearing the same thing, Kate, that I am among my friends and relatives and associates who are teachers or who have been teachers, that there's a little more concern, as there was at the beginning of this, for some of the teachers that are older, that have been doing this, you know, 20, 30, 40 years, and they want to be there, but they're kind of worried about this because of their age and the propensity for any strain of COVID to be tougher on older folks?
Absolutely. I mean, I think our teachers, you know, veteran teachers are a backbone for our school system. They bring with them an incredible amount of, incredible amount of valuable service and understanding and experience. And so to watch those people really debate, is it worth it for me to come back, I think is really difficult. And some of it is the concern about COVID, and then some of it is also the stress that's resulting from the shortages and the some of the micromanaging with the evaluation process. So I think there's a lot of things that are kind of piling onto our educators that we really want to try and start addressing, because I am worried that we're going to take people out of this profession prematurely.
Jocelyn Delancey, I'm reading over the weekend in the past few days, a lot of people, both on the left and the right, kind of unifying in this whole thing that, yeah, these extended outages, if you will, of kids having to be home away from their teachers, not only their teachers, but their other students that play a big part in the socialization skills. You've got experts on all sides now saying this is just not good.
You know, it's hard. This is a really difficult situation, and we know that in-person learning is best, and I think that's why we've been trying to work so hard to make sure that our schools have the supplies they need to stay open and keep kids in classrooms. But it is a community effort. You know, we have to make sure that the virus stays out of our communities so that we can have the proper learning environment. But teachers really need that support from the entire community, because we're an important profession, and the care that we provide for students really matters. And the best place to do that is in person with as many smart and sophisticated educators as possible. And that's just getting harder and harder to do.
Kate, finally for you, look, the numbers are starting to turn a little. We will get past this. You know, COVID's going to be around, but it'll likely drop off again for the summer months. But then a few months after that, there's another school year coming up. So what are your hopes once this surge levels off a little bit? What are your hopes as far as, say, preparing and getting ready for what some doctors are saying could be spurts and spikes for the next several years?
So, you know, I'm really hopeful, to be fair. I really am hopeful that we'll get to a place where we start to understand the spikes, we start to understand the factors, and we implement mitigation strategies, and that we're more proactive than I think I feel. I feel sometimes now that we're chasing solutions when we, you know, to your point, there's probably going to be a certain amount of living with COVID at some point. And that's going to require that we say, okay, we know that masks are a strategy that's resourceful. Let's have those prepared for January of 2023. Let's be ready to go with those. You know, so let's think about things ahead of time and prepare for them. I'm hopeful that we'll be able to get to a point where we can back off masks, open our windows, and really enjoy, you know, traditional classroom experiences where we're able to be very engaging and exciting. And we're able to go back to inviting guests back into our schools and allowing visitors to come to sporting events and really kind of enjoy some of the camaraderie of being in education and being in schools. So I'm hopeful. I think we are learning as we go, and as long as we continue to listen to sort of the public health experts, I think we're going to do the right thing. And that's really what we're looking for, is to follow that guidance, make sure that we are being proactive, and fortunately, we will hopefully get to a point where good things are in our horizon. That's my honest-to-God hope for our school system.
On that note, Kate Diaz, thank you. Kate is the president of the Connecticut Education Association, 21-year math teacher at Manchester High School. And we thank also the vice president of the CEA, Jocelyn DeLancey, a 17-year teacher, grades 3, 4, and 5 in Darien. Folks, thank you so much. We appreciate it. And you're welcome anytime you want to drop by. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, folks.
Thank
Take it easy. Thank you. Have a great day. So what is it with this latest wave we're having of inflation, and all the economics people are saying, hey, it's bad. It's, you know, I guess the worst in two generations back to the early 80s. Joining us right now, gentlemen we've had on the program a couple of times before to talk about this and more, economics professor James Thorson, Southern Connecticut State University in New Haven. Professor, hi, it's Paul on WICC. Good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing very good, thank you.
What do you make of all this, Professor Thorson? We're seeing, I guess, is this the perfect confluence of so much stuff going on at once that this isn't surprising or not? What are your thoughts on that?
I would say it's something that, given all of our circumstances, is not surprising that it happened. It's no fun that it happened, but, you know, we've had supply chain disruptions. You know, energy prices have gone through the roof, and you know, the Fed has also been, you know, very accommodative on its monetary policy. So, you know, it's just kind of a confluence of a whole bunch of policies and events that translate into higher prices.
If my listeners right now were in this massive classroom, Professor, listening to you in one of your lectures, and one of them raised their hands and says, Professor, can you please explain to me the textbook definition of inflation? I hear it a lot. I'm not sure what it is. What would you tell them?
Okay, well, inflation is just an increase in the average level of prices over time. And so what the government does is it thinks of a typical household, and it says we spend so much money on food, we spend so much money on gasoline, so much money on housing, and then it measures the price of those every month, and it basically looks at how much it would cost a household to live from month to month and see how that changes over time.
So is this kind of the scenario, Professor Thorson? I'm a big space guy, rocket guy, for example, and there's a kind of a rocket engine in history, Professor, where if you mix the propellant and the activator together, you don't need much more. It's a natural reaction, and thrust and fire and vapor is created. Is that kind of what we're in now? In other words, if you put certain things together, it's invariable that this reaction will happen?
I mean, I wouldn't say that it's invariable because there's so many moving parts to the economy that sometimes, you know, things will work out just fine. You know, for example, like I said, one big component is energy prices, mm-hmm. and, you know, oil prices have gone up about 50% in the last year. And so therefore, that is just like something that happened, but, you know, a few changes here and there, and we could have had a much lower increase in oil prices or a higher increase. So the problem is that the right set of circumstances, it's probably inevitable, but the problem is that it's one of these things where, you know, you can't control when it happens. There's not that many things that are under our control, I guess.
I'll get back to that momentarily, Professor. Hang on, because that was my next question about, well, can anything really be done before this thing kind of runs its course? More on that and on the economy and on inflation. Professor James Thorson, economics professor, Southern Connecticut State University. More with Professor Thorson straight ahead. First, traffic and weather together right here, 4:36 on WICC. Inflation, yeah, a lot of things costing more, not just gasoline and stuff like that, but everything on up and down through the product chain. James Thorson, a professor of economics from Southern Connecticut State University, is trying to explain it to, well, people like me who don't quite get economics. It's my one college area that I kept going, huh, for 4 years. The other stuff was easy. Professor Thorson, is energy, the price of gasoline, the price of crude oil, stuff like that, is that maybe the common thread, if there is one, as you mentioned, or one of the strongest indicators or causational things of inflation when it does spike like this or not?
Well, I mean, in this case, in this case, it is. Other things are increasing, not quite as much. One of the interesting things is medical care inflation over the past year has been relatively low, about 2.5% or so. Different things will spike at different times. Like another thing that's really spiked in the last year is used car prices are about 37% higher than they were 12 months ago. So it's really a big basket of things, but things like energy and food are the big things that we spend money on. And so they're always going to have a bigger impact on inflation than some of these smaller things.
And this does show, does it not, Professor, how we may be talking about different things, car prices, food, gasoline, but in a big way, they're all kind of intertwined, aren't they? I mean, everything kind of rises and then everything kinds of settles down here.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, it's things like energy prices, a lot of things will go up in price, and then the market is going to adjust to them, and then prices will decline a bit. So that happens in energy prices all the time. All of a sudden, energy prices get higher, and then, the U.S. starts drilling more oil, and other countries start drilling more oil, prices come back down. Used car prices start getting high, we have more cars coming onto the market, and prices come back down again. So there's an ebb and flow to the market that does tend to adjust these things over time. So most of the time this is a temporary problem.
I've read, Professor, so many predictions of all from academia and business as to when we might see prices ease off and drop again. Some are saying a few months, other folks saying a year and a half. Any thoughts on this? What does the James Thorson crystal ball say, if you have it out and polished up?
I would say, somewhere between 6 months and a year, there's just still some parts of our economy that are really kind of bogged down. And I think once they start freeing up, I think you'll get inflation starting to subside a bit.
I see one professor of your areas of expertise is real estate. Why are home prices going through the roof here? I mean, some of the prices people are getting for their homes, especially a home that they may have purchased some time ago. I mean, just selling their home is setting themselves up for retirement here. Why are these home prices so high?
I think part of it is, there's a, especially in places like Connecticut, people don't have to be in large cities anymore. And, if you look at Connecticut, we're much more affordable than, New York City and Boston and those type of places. And so I think that makes us just a whole lot more attractive. Been amazing how real estate prices have just in certain areas gone through the roof. And, it's interesting how they've really kind of flattened out to some extent, because there are some places that used to be very rural where real estate prices have increased dramatically in some of those areas.
Finally, Professor, what do you anticipate the federal government doing, the Federal Reserve, as far as pumping money and interest rates and all that? I mean, is there anything they can do, or are they just going to sit back and maybe let this thing cool down just a bit?
I expect that the Fed is going to be raising the interest rates, which is going to slow down spending a little bit. I mean, the thing they have to be careful about is they don't want to send the economy into a recession. If they did this too fast, we could put the economy into a recession. And so then you have a trade-off. We don't want high prices, but we also don't want high unemployment. But if they do it in a measurable way, they may be able to lower the inflation rate without reducing economic growth and increasing unemployment. So that's kind of the big thing that I could see. And then, if some of the things could be done to help ease the supply chain issues, that would also help too.
And let me add one more on the top of that, Professor. Please give me your thought on which I don't get, the cryptocurrency. I've seen the wild swings in this. I know people that got a piece of cryptocurrency on a lark years ago, and now they look down, they've got like $50,000 in the bank. I mean, is this going to last? Is this a mirage? What are your thoughts on this? Because I frankly don't understand it.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's my thing on cryptocurrency. I mean, I look at, you know, cryptocurrency a lot like gold, except gold is something tangible you can touch. You know, gold prices can go up really high and then fall dramatically. But it's all based on somebody's subjective value. It's a collective subjective value.
Uh-huh.
And that's why, you know, I've always been kind of skeptical of cryptocurrency because, you know, this is all a subjective value. And right now it's very popular, but it's actually decreased in popularity. And so the prices have come down a bit. But I mean, I don't have a rational explanation of why, you know, I can't say why Bitcoin is worth X number of dollars and, you know, 5 years ago it was worth $500, you know, and I guess.
Thank you. Well, because that's what I'm saying. I'm like, I don't get this. Am I that dumb? No, I just not. Huh?
No. It's really. I find it perplexing myself.
Oh, great. Excellent. Now I know that at least I have a kindred spirit here.
Yes.
Professor James Thorson, economics professor at Southern Connecticut State University. Professor, good to speak with you again. Take care, and we'll talk down the road. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Bye-bye. Yeah, folks. I mean, well, you know, it's come down a little, but, you know, one Bitcoin, $50,000, $45,000. There's nothing backing it up. It's like, is monopoly money? I don't get it. But I guess he's right. When you put a subjective value on something, then it has value. Why, for example, do we value diamonds and rubies and gemstones and emeralds? They're rocks. They're really pretty rocks. But essentially, we pay lots of money for rocks.